you picture poor Job down there at the Mason Clinic, you know. All of us coming up to help him out. Oh, my. Lord is so good. All right, chapter 2. We just got through discussing about Job's sickness and how long it lasted. It was not good. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible disease. Brought him down to skin and bones. Left him in continual pain and suffering. With loss of sleep. And now we find his wife getting in on the picture here in Job chapter 2 and verse 9. And that's where we left off. Job 2 and verse 9. And then said his wife unto him, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." As I mentioned, the word curse here means to take leave of, as in bowing. So you just bow out, Job, and die. We see here that Satan is using Job's wife, moving her also against Job. She's basically all he had left. Now, question. His family was taken. His kids were taken. His possessions were taken. But not his wife. How come? How come his wife wasn't taken? Everything else was gone. And his health, too. Now, how come his wife was not taken? I have 5 reasons. Number 1, I think the devil left her possibly partly because he wanted to use her as his greatest enemy. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 36 says, "Your greatest enemies are they of your own household." Your greatest foes are they of your own household. They can also be your greatest friends, by the way. It just depends on what side they take. It's because they're so close to you. They're so close to you. They can be your greatest friend or your greatest enemy. Also in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 through 11, we have there the account of Moses saying that if the wife of thy youth, even she, if she entices you to worship false gods, report her to the elders and stone her with stones. And you be the first one to stone her. And it's a real, and it says, let not thine eye pity, because of course that's what you'd naturally want to do. I mean, she's your wife, the wife of your youth, your precious darling. He said, don't let your eye pity, because those that are closest to you are going to do you the greatest damage when they turn against the Word of God. You see that in young people all the time. Your friends are either going to really lift you up or tear you down. They're your greatest foes when they're against you, see? Because you're so impacted by them. So it's very possible the devil left her to put the what do they call it, the coup de grace on him? To finally nail him, wipe him out, and put the thought in his mind. Everybody else was gone. Nobody else would say that to him except his wife. And so there we go. That's possibly. Number 2. It's also possible that God wanted her left so that she would be the one that would take care of him. Because he needed somebody. I mean, he couldn't do anything for himself. He had to get food. He had to be taken care of. It's possible that God did not want her taken for his benefit. Thirdly, and this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but remember after he was blessed, he received double everything he had? And God didn't want him to have double trouble, so he just left the first wife and said, "I won't have to." Number 4. She's left possibly by God to show how the wife is one with the husband in all things. Because we are. When they go through it, you go through it. When your mate goes through it, you go through it. Because we're one in those things. Fifthly, she possibly left as a type of the self-life. You know, no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cares for it as Christ the church, here's his flesh talking to him, saying, curse God and die. Perfect type. So she represents the flesh, the self-life. The self-life. Now, why would she, his wife, tell him to curse God? Why would she do that? She knew that ultimately everything came from God. She knew ultimately everything came from God. And she also knew that life was God's design, and therefore to be eagerly pursued. But since God is the author of life, if you curse God, you'll lose life. She knew that. If you curse God, you'll lose life. And therefore, it would result in death. And therefore, it would lead to a release from the pain and the misery. She knew, in other words, that God was holding Job's soul in life. In fact, Job himself knew that and talks about it later. He knew that God was the one that was keeping him alive, and he wished he wouldn't. He wished he'd just kill it. And she knew that too. And therefore, she knew if he just cursed God, then he'd be able to die, and it'd be all over, and the misery and the pain would cease. She was looking at her temporal benefit and realizing also that it was his pain that she was feeling, and it was a suffering to her, and she did not want to go through that pain. And so she figured, well, Job, you curse God, then you'll die, and then I won't have to go through this suffering. Selfishness. And because of those motives, the devil was able to use her as a mouthpiece. It reminds me of how Peter came against Christ. You know Jesus loved Peter. Jesus loved Peter. Jesus cared for Peter. Jesus liked being around Peter. Peter was one of his inner three. He was close to Jesus' heart. And it was Peter that the devil used to speak to Christ, "Let it not be so, Lord. Have mercy on yourself." And he said, "I rebuke you, Satan. Get thee behind me, for you savor not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men." And that's exactly what was happening here. So it's the greatest temptation, because it was so close to Job's heart. She inevitably, therefore, and unwittingly became a tool of Satan. Just stop the battle. Quit fighting. Just give up. Just give up. You know, that temptation is almost always there when the going gets tough. Just give up. Just give up. Quit. You know, take the easy way out. Don't let yourself go on into glory. You don't need all those crowns of glory. You don't need all those jewels in heaven. You don't need all those rewards. Lose it all. Just give up. Rotten devil. Trying to steal away the blessing of God. His shame was her shame. She loved being with him as long as he was rich and wealthy and carrying on. Now she was unwilling to receive the chastisement, to receive the embarrassment, to receive the pain, to receive the difficulty. She basically wanted him to act as other men would have acted. Most men would have cursed God and died. Most men would have cursed God and died. Job was one of the few, if not the only one, that wouldn't have in his age. And she saw the integrity that he had. He was unflinching, unyielding. He wouldn't give up, and it scared her. You mean we're going to have to go through this? I tell you, women, be careful in the ministry. God puts something in the heart of your husband, and he sets his face like flint. Don't you do anything to deter that. You undergird and support him. You don't want to be a tool of Satan to try to draw him to one side or another. So she became that mouthpiece of what Satan wanted him to hear. And she was the closest one to him. And so she is the one that the devil found available in order to strike that arrow of curse God into his heart. Because that's what the devil said he would do. He said, "He'll curse you to his face, your face." That's what he said he'd do. Look at verse 10. "But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh, What shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? And all this did not Job sin with his lips. Glory to God, glory to God. First of all, I'd like you to notice something. He didn't condemn her. He condemned her action. In the midst of all this suffering, he still wasn't getting in the flesh. You know, half of us sitting here this morning, if we were sick and a little bit out of, you know, a little bit weak or whatever, we'll probably be out of sorts, huh? Somebody get in our path, we'll get irritated and maybe, hey! You know? And here he is in such torments and pain, scraping himself of this oozing matter, sitting in ashes, and he still did not get upset and snap back at her. Some of us have the wrong, you know, we have a wrong side of the bed in our house, you know, some of us.
I got up on the wrong side of the bed this morning.
No, you just took a demon along with you when you got up, that's all. There's no wrong side of the bed. You can flip out every side you want. It's just who you take with you when you get up, that's all. He did not even attack her. Most of us say, you are a foolish woman. He didn't say that. He said, you speak as a foolish woman. Most of us tend to condemn people's character. Parents are notorious at this, and it's totally wrong. You're a bad boy. Instead of, that was a bad decision. And we condemn their character. And many of us grew up under that, where we are getting condemned all our life as being a bad girl, a bad boy. Something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. Instead of, I have made some bad choices. And there's a world of difference. The one attacks your self-esteem, the other builds it up and lets you know there's a better way and you can take it if you want. Job acted righteously. Now, the foolish women, there is a class. Foolish women, you speak as one of the foolish women. That is, women that are tied to their circumstances and can only see that which is immediate and temporal. And it's a tendency. It's a tendency. A virtuous woman, who can find, Bible says. And it also says that a virtuous woman is an heritage of the Lord. I mean, it's a gift of God to find a woman that is virtuous. We'll be getting into this a little bit later, but in Ecclesiastes 7, 26 through 29, Solomon said he searched high and low to find that kind of a woman, and he didn't find one. He searched high and low to find that kind of a man, and he only found one among a thousand. Not very many of those either. But among the women, he didn't find any. And it shows you how difficult it is for a man just in himself to walk with God. We tend not to. But the tendency is even harder for women because of the weaker nature, tied more to circumstances, just the way the creation is. More emotional, more subject to intrigue, therefore deception, not as logical generally. In other words, looking at the immediate benefit, and God has created a woman, it's a beautiful creation to be able to deal with the situations at hand, the immediate details of life, especially with children in the home. But it can keep her from looking at the eternal. It can keep her from seeing the far-reaching, long range. And so, therefore, we find that women are more tend to gossip than men do, because they're involved with more of the immediate details of life, and also tend to be more fickle and more of a busybody. And that's just the way it has turned out. And therefore, she needs to be submissive to her husband. She needs to walk by faith and not by sight. Here, this woman walked by sight. And I'm sure she was a godly woman in general. I'm sure she was. I'm sure she found her place in heaven's land, I'm sure. But she was used of the devil, just like Peter was. She was used of the devil at this point. And brother, when you're down and when you're weak, and then to have one who is your closest strike you with such an arrow, it's hard. It's hard. We have to be careful, especially at those times, to hold our tongue and to watch what we say. Now, Job's response not only was righteous toward his wife, but also he says, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? Now, in saying this, Job acknowledged five things. He acknowledged God five ways, I should say. He acknowledged God five ways. Number one, as controller of all things. God gives good and He gives evil. He controls all things. Number two, he also acknowledges God as the owner of his life. Therefore, he had no right to self-destruction. He had no right to self-destruction. Remember what I said? I said, a suicide is cursing God. It's cursing God. He wouldn't admit to that. Thirdly, he's acknowledging God as all-wise and all-knowing, therefore to be trusted. Shall we receive good at the hand of the Lord and not evil? He's implying that we'll receive both because God knows. He's all-wise, and so we'll receive both. Fourthly, he also acknowledges God as all-powerful and therefore to be obeyed. You don't buck God. He allows these things. You shut your lip and you walk on in obedience. That's what you do. You receive good and you receive evil. If you can rejoice at the good, then what is all this business about not liking the evil? You either submit or you don't. You don't pick and choose. Either he's your God or he's not. Fifthly, he also acknowledges God as loving. Therefore, to be loved and trusted, knowing that he's touched with our infirmities. Now, some people, again, the Blessing Pact preachers do not like this statement. Shall we receive good at the hand of the Lord and not evil? And they say, oh, unbelief again. No. Tremendous faith. How? Why? Well, let me tell you what the pagans do. They worship whoever is the strongest god. And so if they start receiving evil at the hand of their god, they turn to some other god. That's exactly what's happening in Christendom. They count it all to the devil, therefore, if they got some difficulties in life or if they're not filthy rich. No wonder it's wrecked the faith of so many. And whereas the heathen, you know, is doing the same thing. He's looking for self-benefit, and whatever feeds the flesh the most, that's the god they follow. That's the god they follow. When they find a stronger god, they'll follow him. But look at Job. He's serving God because he's God. That's faith. He's serving God because of who God is, not because of what he does. That's faith. In other words, he's looking way beyond the temporal circumstances to who God himself is. Let me say something. That's the way God relates to us. Do you know he doesn't relate to us according to what we do? If he did, the Bible says we'd all be damned. If God marked iniquities, who could stand? If he took you into account for every failure, every sin, every error you made, brethren, I'll tell you, we'd live behind the woodshed. We'd live there. We'd all be a bloody heap back there with big, huge clubs on us, you know. He doesn't. He deals with you according to who you are. You're his child. Whew, praise God. Glad I'm not his enemy. Glad I'm on his side. Says God is angry with the wicked every day. You don't want to be on the other side of God's anger. And so, he deals with us that way too. So we ought to deal with him that way, according to who he is. And not just go by our carnal understanding of what he does. But deal with him according to who he is. That's how we need to deal with one another too. You see, Job had a revelation of God's nature. He knew basically that he could count it all joy, ultimately, even though now he was in torments of his soul. But he knew ultimately he could count it all joy. That's what he said later in Job 23:10, as I mentioned. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. You see, God does have full control. Let me give you a verse here that some people balk at. Isaiah 45 and verse 7. Let me start verse 6. That they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am Yahweh, and there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Some people say, that's not in my Bible. I just read it out of Isaiah 45 and verse 7. Because he is the ultimate controller of all things. He's the ultimate controller of all things. God is. Therefore, Job knew that. Job also knew Isaiah 54 and verse 16. And he didn't have it to read either. We have it to read and we have trouble. But listen to this. Behold, I, this is God speaking again, have created the smith that blows the coals in the fire. Getting hot? Your life getting hot? You feel that heat underneath you? Somebody was over there standing by a billows, puffing on it. His name's the devil, Satan. God made him. He's over there just carrying out his task. That's just the way he is. And that bringeth forth an instrument for his work. And I have created the waster to destroy. You got a waster destroying? God made him. God's the one that created him. Allowed him to be. It was God. Now, for the unbeliever, that's scary. But for the believer, it's hope. Why is that hope? Why is it hope? The next verse here in Isaiah 54 is verse 17. This is the hope that comes out of the heart of the believer who knows that God is the one that even created the devil. No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. Since I made the waster that to destroy, and since I love you, therefore everything he makes against you is not going to prosper. And every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord. Praise God. It'd be as if you were living in one kingdom and there was another kingdom close by that was your enemy and they were always attacking you. But let's say you were a queen and that's a king over that kingdom. You fell in love with each other. Hey, no problem anymore. If you fall in love and he falls in love with you and he's the guy that's over the enemy, no problem. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be just fine. He'll take care of you. Just trust him. So, Job's confidence was in God, who knows us and who perfects us. He knows us and he perfects us. I want you to know the man-child is going to have the same heart that Job has. He's, by the way, a type of the man-child. But I'd like to read Psalm 139. And this is a prophecy that really does fit with the man-child company. Psalm 139, verses 11 through 13. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hides not from thee, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. For thou hast possessed my reins. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. In other words, even if I go into the night, I know to you it's light. Even though to me it's dark, I know to God it's light, so it's no problem. So whether I'm walking in the day or whether I'm stumbling in the night, God is for me, He's with me, He's watching me, so everything's going to be all right. I will yet praise Thee. I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Praise the Lord. He said, and then it says, and all this did not Job sin with his lips. The Hebrew for sin means to miss. It comes from the idea of to miss. He did not miss with his lips. He was right on, brethren. He was right on. And we need to be right on, too. And not charge God foolishly. All right. Verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite. You'll get to know those three really well. For they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. Three. The number three is kind of an interesting number in the Bible as far as typology. And it's not super clear cut, but it probably means something along the lines of deliverance and victory, but also judgment. And they came with all three, I think. Now Eliphaz, a Temanite, let's look at him. You'll need to know these names and you'll need to know about them. Eliphaz, a Temanite, he was the chief speaker. Eliphaz means God is dispenser. God is dispenser. And he really did come trying to dispense from God what God's mind should be. And plus he himself felt that he was sent of the Lord. He felt he himself was dispensed by God. And he was the Temanite. Now, as far as knowing about Teman, Teman was a district of Idumea. It was a district of Idumea, and it was renowned for its wisdom. Jeremiah 49 and verse 7. Jeremiah 49 and verse 7. It's mentioned. So, that's interesting. That also puts us in the area down by the Edom, down by north, south and east of the Dead Sea, which is where we previously thought Job probably lived. Then let's look at Bildad the Shuhite. Bildad means son of contention. And that's basically about what he did. When he came to Job, he came basically just to prove himself to be right. And he's Bildad the Shuhite. Some feel possibly that he descended from Shua, who was the son of Abraham through Keturah. Shua, which was the son of Abraham through Keturah. Some feel maybe he descended from them. Genesis 25 and verse 2. And that son, again, dwelt in the area of Arabia, not far from Idumea. So that still puts us in the same area. Zophar the Naamathite. Zophar means hairy or rough. Or it's possible it also means to depart. And he was very rough, and he was very crude. And he looked at the situation basically through carnal eyes. He was the least courteous of the three. Now, all of these three lived, therefore, in the east, along with Job. And it's interesting that several places, including the book Baruch, I don't know how you pronounce it, it's part of the Old Testament Apocrypha, it celebrates the wisdom of the inhabitants of Edom. And that was also done in Jeremiah 49:7, as I mentioned earlier. And these three, therefore, were also very wise men. And their speeches were also very deep, but we'll find out that their understanding didn't go quite as deep. And the three are given in the order of the most spiritual, if you can put it that way, down to the least. Eliphaz definitely being the most courteous and having the most insight, and Bildad a little bit less, and Zophar a little bit less. Now, the fact that Teman and Shua and Naamath, that these words, names, may have similarities after the time of Abraham does not really give us a definite date, because sometimes a person is called a thing because of where he lived as to the name later after his death. And he wasn't called this when he was alive. He was only called this later in order to identify him. So we really don't know. But all of these, like Teman and Shua, and those are all names that were back in the time of the patriarchs. Now, all of these men, these three men, were older than Job. They were old men, and they were older than Job. Chapter 32 and verse 6. Chapter 32 and verse 6. This is Elihu speaking. You haven't met him yet. We'll introduce you in a little bit to him. And Elihu the son of Barakel the Buzite answered and said, I am young, and ye are very old. Wherefore I was afraid and durst not show you mine opinion. Ye are very old. So these are older men. Also chapter 15 and verse 10. With us are both the gray-headed and very aged men, much elder than thy father. In other words, those three men could have been the father of Job. You know what I mean? As far as age. So with us are the gray-headed and those much older than your father, Job. So they were older men, and they were older than Job. And Job could have been their son, you know, as far as age. And yet they were all older than Elihu. All right, verse 12. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. And they rent everyone his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. This is a positive thing that they're doing here, because they're showing fellow feeling for Job's affliction. They are mourning with him. You know, the Bible says, weep with those that weep, rejoice with those that rejoice. They're weeping with him. It's a sign of compassion and a sign of pity. Verse 13. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Interesting, 7 days is the time of mourning for those who have died. They sat down and mourned with him as long as you would if he died. I mean, this thing was serious. And also notice the compassion of these men, willing to stay there that long. And they never said one word to him. So, that's the setting. And that begins, that's the prologue, and that is the beginning now of the speeches. Yes?
What was the name?
As I went through that, I wondered myself because I didn't have it down.
I think what it is Naamath. Naamath is possibly a place in Idumea near the border of Judea. And that's what I do have down. Yes, I do have it down. Naamath was possibly a place in Judea, in Idumea, near the border of Judea. And that's all that's known about that. Kind of went by quickly. Yes?
In verse 12, it said they knew him not.
Yes.
That doesn't really mean that they didn't recognize him, because they obviously came and sat down with him, right?
Oh, yeah. They just couldn't recognize him from what they knew him to look like.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's like if you went to visit your grandma and hadn't seen her for a while, and went to visit her in the hospital, and she was emaciated, and you couldn't recognize her, but you knew it was her, but you couldn't recognize her. Okay, now I want to address a question: what kind of a man was Job? What kind of a man was Job? We're going to find out that Job got a dirty deal in this book. And he's getting a dirty deal now. The people are slamming him as being an unrighteous man. But let's look and find out what kind of a man he was. Well, we find, first of all, three times the same description is given of him. It's in chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 8, and chapter 2, verse 3. The first time in verse 1 is just stated. It's written in the prologue. The second two times, it's given by God. And each time it's the same four words that are used to describe Job. The first word is used as perfect, in the Hebrew meaning to be complete. He was a complete man. It also can carry the idea of being gentle or pious. He was a perfect, complete, pious man. The second term is upright, meaning straight. He was straight, that is, not deviating. But he was set like flint to follow God. He was an upright man. Thirdly, he feared God. He had a fear of God. And fourthly, he eschewed evil. That is, he turned off evil. Eschew means to turn off, to literally, or to depart. He departs from evil or turns off from evil. And so he wouldn't have anything to do with evil. This is the description of Job. Now, And do you believe it or don't you believe it? I believe it. And there are so many efforts made by modern-day charismatics to try to get Job to be some horrible sinner, because certainly he must have done something wrong to have all that go wrong with him. And that's exactly what the three friends kept telling him. And guess what God did to them? At the end of the whole thing, he said, "You guys blew it, and you blew it bad. And if Job doesn't pray for you, you better watch out lest I come and wipe you out. And so you better offer some sacrifices, and you better go to my servant Job and have him pray for you. Because you spoke that which was evil in my sight." And that's exactly what the Church of Jesus Christ is doing today. And we do it to one another all the time, saying, "Boy, certainly you must have done something wrong to have all that go wrong in your life." And there we are, back in the same pit. Self-righteousness. That's basically what it is. So, he's perfect, upright, fears God, and eschews evil. And that's the truth, and he was. And there was none like him in all the East. Now, what proof do we have of his heart? The only proof that we have of his righteousness is seen in chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. I mean, as far as initially. The only proof we have is what's seen in chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. So, let's look at it. "And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus did Job continually." That's the only example we have of Job's type of life. Now, interesting enough, the Blessing Pack preachers take these two verses as being a particular and unique exposure of Job's unusual wickedness. Because his kids were totally out of control. They were just carousing and getting drunk and feasting all the time. And Job was just in a dither as to what to do, and he was offering all these sacrifices, and he knew that they were cursing God. And I mean, it was a mess. The whole thing was a mess. I'm going to show you that it's exactly the opposite. Can you imagine God doing this, saying, here's a perfect man, upright, fears God, and eschews evil, and he's a mess. He's living in sin, and he's in unbelief, and he's in fear. And the guy is in... Hey, wait. That's contradiction. You just got through saying he was perfect, upright, fears God, eschews evil, and then he's living like this. No. This is a unique example of how righteous he was. That's what we're going to find out. Now we find that his sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone his day. Or feasted in the house of him whose day it was. And it most probably is referring to their birthday. And after everyone had had their feast in each one of the sons' house, in other words, once a year, Job would take them and he would offer sacrifices for them. And there's some... I don't think I'll spend much time on it, but some people feel that, well, maybe each son had a day of the week. And so that meant that they had 7 days, and then at the end of the week he offered sacrifices. But that would mean they feasted every day, and that means he'd offer sacrifices once a week. And that's just too much. You don't feast every day. There's no way you can handle that. Birthdays would be more reasonable. And or some say it was 1 week out of the year when they would feast every day of that week. That doesn't fit either, because the feasts of the East, you don't do them every day. You can't handle it. It'd be too much. So it undoubtedly is their birthday. That's the thing that seems to fit the most, and most commentators tend towards that. It'd be their birthday, so he offered sacrifices once a year. This is an expression of how close the family was. They stayed knit. And also, they included their sisters, and that was unusual for a couple reasons. First of all, if you were having a drunken brawl, you would not invite your sisters. Second of all, it was against the custom to invite the sisters. But they did, showing the tremendous worth of these women. And that his sons put great value on them, even though it was not according to custom. Put great value on them. And that would be, again, pointing out their unique closeness and their unique love. We also see that Job maintained authority over them. Notice he maintained authority over them, because it says in verse 5 that when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them. Meaning they came when he sent for them. They submitted unto him. We also see that Job understood sanctification. And the sanctifying was probably washings. He probably had them wash their clothes and immerse their bodies. That's probably what he had them do. Even before the law, God had Israel sanctify themselves. And how they did it was wash their clothes and immerse their bodies. And it's mentioned in Exodus 19 and verse 14. Also, Job had an understanding of sacrifice. Now, the Hebrew word for sacrifice here does not primarily point to blood sacrifice as much as to ascending sacrifices. That is, whole burnt offerings. Sacrifices that were burnt up totally and ascended from the earth up into the air through the smoke, and were therefore given and transferred to God. And so it's talking about a total commitment. It's representing a total commitment and a total giving of self over to God. It's possible that, you know, of course, I don't know, who knows what he knew as far as sacrifices. This wasn't sacrifices under the Mosaic law or anything. So it would have come from Abel, you know, and from Noah, the information that he had. And their love for God, and he carried on in the same, continued on in the same relationship. Now the question about his children is, were they righteous children or were they unrighteous children? Because he offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all, which, by the way, would be a very expensive offering. A very expensive offering. These animals that would be burnt up unto God, just given totally to God, for their sanctification, for their redemption. But what kind of children were they? Because it said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And so he did it continually. Well, the question is then, did Job bring up his children to love God? My answer is absolutely yes. It's proven by the way it's stated here. In fact, do you know why these two verses are the things that are used to express what Job's heart was? It's because how you relate to your family and those that are closest to you is the most accurate expression of what you are. It's the most accurate expression of what and who you are. How you relate to those that are closest to you. Because everybody can put on the shine out in the public. But how you deal with those that are with you day by day by day is a representation of who you are. An eye-opener for some. It shows you what you got inside. And this is the same thing that was used by God to describe Abraham's unique righteousness. I'd like to read it in Genesis 18, 17 through 19. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him?" Why is all that going to happen to Abraham? It tells you in verse 19. "For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him." Wow. Abraham shall be blessed. Why? Because he will bring up his family to serve God. That's why. Because God knew him, and he knew the integrity of Abraham's heart. And he knew that he would take the sacrifice and the commitment to make sure that his family is brought up right. That's the same thing that's now being shown about Job. How do we know he's a righteous man? Because of how he brought up his family, his love, his sacrifice, his giving for his family, his care for them. That is the unique expression of his unique righteousness. Well, then you ask, well, why was there such a fear of their sinning? Why was there such a fear of their sinning? Well, first of all, it's not necessarily that there was a lot of fear. It may have been more just of his thoughtful care. You know he loved them deeply, number one. He did. He loved his children deeply. He was a righteous man. Secondly, you also know that he was a patriarchal head, and therefore he held responsibility for the whole clan, just like Abraham did and Isaac did. He held responsibility for the whole clan. Thirdly, in a time of feasting, it would be very easy to get a little carried away, huh? In a time of feasting? Although, this feasting was not a negative thing. This is a very positive thing. In this setting, and in this Old Testament setting, you know when Abraham had a feast? When Yahweh and the two angels visited him. Is that negative? No, it's positive. The feasts were positive. You know what God had the Israelite do three times a year? Have feasts. Feasts, three times a year. Well, the whole nation get together and feast it up. That's right, that's what happened. And it was joyous times of the year. It wasn't a summer, you know, and just come in there and just, you know, everybody be sad. No, it was feast time. It was feast time the three times a year. That's what they had, feasts. Notice also it says, "It may be that my sons have sinned." It may be. Obviously, therefore, it wasn't obvious. He couldn't see it. It may be. He was just taking precautions. He was just reminding them of their sacrifice before God, of their indebtedness to God. That's what he was doing. Look, it also says, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Therefore, it wasn't an open cursing of God. He couldn't see any cursing of God. He was just concerned lest there be a cursing of God in their heart. And by the way, this word curse, again, is that same Hebrew there meaning to bow and therefore to say farewell or to take leave of. He was afraid that maybe they had taken leave of God in their hearts. Maybe they had lost the reverence towards God that they needed. Maybe they were acting as if God wasn't around anymore. So it's obvious that they were not openly sinning. Everything was fine on the outside. He was just making sure that they kept the same amount of reverence before God, even after feasting. And the feasting was good. Notice also that he sacrificed before them all for each one. each one was sacrificed for before them all. So this was a real solemn and a formal and a very, wealthy, but a very costly sacrifice. This thing would have an impact on them to bring them into remembrance of who they were. They were the Lord's and how they owed Him everything. And how they were to be just as that animal, totally sacrificed over unto God. You know what Job was doing? He was doing what every good parent should do. Bringing up his children in the nurture and the admonishment of the Lord. That's what he was doing. He was just bringing them into remembrance before God. He was continuing their spiritual growth. This is representing how he brought them up to serve and love God. He was simply fulfilling his station as the patriarch and as the head over the home. He was fulfilling Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12, exhorting one another daily. You say, well, that's just once a year. You know how often Abraham sacrificed? We only have it recorded, once every 25 years or whatever. I mean, we do not have it recorded that he sacrificed that often. Job did it every year. An animal for each of his children. In front of them all, after he had sanctified them. That's much more than what Abraham did. That's more than what Abraham did. And you know how godly a man Abraham was. I'm telling you, Job was a godly man. He was unique. There wasn't one like him in the whole world. A righteous man. And he still held fast his integrity, God said about him. In chapter 2 and verse 3, after his first affliction, God told the devil he still holds fast his integrity. And that word integrity comes from the same Hebrew word for perfect. He still holds fast his perfection, his completeness. He still holds fast his innocence. He hasn't lost it, devil. He still got it. And he didn't sin with his lips after the second affliction either. Therefore, Job was a very righteous man, a perfect man, upright. Fears God and eschews evil. And the proof of it is how he dealt with his family. You know, in this move of God right now, people can get their eyes off of their responsibility, kind of leave the family in the dust, and take off with, other things. I tell you, that wounds a child. That wounds a child. They've got to know that you love them, that you're caring for them. Yes?
It's kind of interesting that it doesn't mention him having multiple wives.
Right.
But
Yeah.
That's
interesting. Yes. Right. That's interesting. Yep. We don't know for sure, but it only mentions his one wife, and it only mentions him as having one, which would also be another possible indication that he had the revelation from Adam, that in the beginning God intended it to be a man and a wife, and so that's another possibility. Interesting. Good. So, let's look at the overall theme. The overall theme is Job gets afflicted. Twice. And the devil is making a play for his soul, and God is willing to allow it because he wants to bring greater glory to Job. And he'll never let you be tempted above what you're able to bear. The friends see it and they come to comfort and to console him. But the first thing that happens is Job curses the day of his birth. We'll be looking at that really shortly. And because of that, boy, does it ever get them going. And they basically feel that, Job, if you'll just repent, certainly God will release you. Obviously, there must be some sin in your life that you've been hiding all these years. But Job denies it and he says, no, I'm righteous. I am not afflicted for anything that I've done wrong. And so they argue back and forth for many, many, many chapters. That's basically what happens. And what happens is that one of them speaks, Job answers. The next one speaks, Job answers. The third one speaks, Job answers. And then they go through it three times. Three times. Only the last time around, the last two, Bildad, he only speaks a short six-verse blurb. And Zophar, he doesn't even speak the third time. He's so upset. And so it ends at a draw. The three friends are upset at Job. And Job is crushed under the weight of all of their blasphemy, as it were. They're not caring for his soul at all. And by the time they're done with him, his suffering is so unbearable, the condemnation is so heavy upon him, he's had to fight for his own righteousness, that he steps into an error himself. And he justified himself instead of God. And so both sides have fallen into silence and into trouble. And that's when Elihu steps in. Elihu starts in chapter 32. Elihu, he knows what's going on. He has the revelation of God. He pours revelation on both sides. He is not mentioned before, and he's not mentioned after. He just appears on the scene, gives the revelation of God, and disappears. That's all we know about him. And he exalts God, and he brings the situation into focus. He points out Job's folly, and he points out the three friends and their sin. And then, after he is done, God speaks. And he starts speaking in chapter 38. And he speaks basically all the way through chapter 41. And God basically just points out that he's omnipotent. And he humbles Job by how he speaks. But he doesn't give Job any answers. And then after it's all over, God justifies Job and says, "My servant Job spoke right." He condemns the three friends and he said, "You guys blew it a million miles." And he has Job pray for those three friends as they sacrifice unto God. And then God releases Job and blesses him and gives him double as what he had before. And heals him. Now, if we are going to understand this book as we enter into it, there's some questions that I want to answer right at the outset. And that is, there's four basic questions I want to answer here. Number one, how did the three friends speak wrong? Because see, that's what we find out at the book, end of the book. And let me give you that verse. How did the three friends speak wrong? That's the first question I want to answer. And we see that they did speak wrong in chapter 42 in verses 7 and 8. Chapter 42, verses 7 and 8. "And it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job has.'" So they spoke wrong. The second question we want to address is, how did Job speak right? Because God says, "You didn't speak right like my servant Job did." So Job did speak right. So we want to answer the second question, how did Job speak rightly? And then there's a third question. How did Elihu speak rightly? And we know he spoke rightly because he attributed himself as being the representative of God, and there's never a reproof given, and the revelations he gave fit perfectly with what God was trying to say. And so we know that Elihu spoke rightly. And then the fourth question is, how did Job speak wrongly? And how do we know that he spoke wrongly? Because God said so. In chapter 38, verses 2 through 4. "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I'll demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding.'" So Job's getting it. Behind the woodshed for Job. But a whole different way. You know what? When you go to the place of righteousness, iniquity is there. Job was the one who spoke rightly, and yet there was error. And when you go to the place of iniquity, righteousness is there. We'll go at the three friends, we'll see how wrong they were, and yet they said some right things. You know, if there's ever a dispute, you know, in this move of God, there's some people that say, "Ah, this can't be of God," and others are saying, "Boy, if anything ever is of God, this is of God." You got different camps. You go to one camp, and maybe they're basically right. There's iniquity there. You go to the other camp, maybe they're basically wrong. There's righteousness there. You know, we need to be really slow at how we speak about our brethren. You know, you go down to the Lutheran church down there, and though we might say they're basically off, you'll find righteousness there. You'll find people there that love God. You'll find people there that have a good attitude about things. Then you walk down the street, the community chapel, supposed to be basically right, you'll find iniquity there. You know? You'll find iniquity there. We may sin more justifying ourselves. Hey, we're all red hot and they're all shot. That may be our greatest sin right there. Puffing ourselves up. I tell you, we're going to find some things about that. The human heart is deceitful. And that's why you just want to justify God and not do too much about justifying yourself. And we'll see that as we carry on through here. So I want to answer those four questions because it will help you get things into focus as we move into the speeches so that you can understand what's going on. Okay.